This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket by Benjamin Lohr. This book is read by Benjamin Lohr. Murray came out of an aisle and walked alongside Babette, just ahead of us. He took a twin roll of paper towels out of her cart and smelled it. This place recharges us spiritually. It prepares us. It's a gateway. The large doors slide open, they close unbidden. Energy waves, incident radiation. All the letters and numbers are here, all the colors of the spectrum, all the voices and sounds, all the code words and ceremonial phrases. It is just a question of deciphering, rearranging, peeling off the layers of unspeakability. Not that we would want to. Not that any useful purpose would be served. Don DeLillo, White Noise. Introduction. Between the ice and you. In short, her shopping is primarily an act of love, that in its daily conscientiousness becomes one of the primary means by which relationships of love and care are constituted by practice. That is to say, shopping does not merely reflect love, but is a major form in which love is manifested and reproduced. As Parker has noted, love for infants is inevitably accompanied by hatred and resentment. Daniel Miller, A Theory of Shopping. Let's look beneath the ice-chipped surface of a fish counter at a Whole Foods in New York City. This happens every other month after closing. The customers leave, the checkout crew changes into street clothes, the store goes into lockdown to prevent its own employees from robbing them. Shifts change, and the ceaseless, shitty Hall & Oates music stops and is replaced by silence. Night workers, a motley rainbow of low English, low skill, low smile workers, come in, knee pads over long pants to restock the shelves, like a reverse midnight harvest. They stoop over, heads down in their Kind Bar TM shirts, or whatever functional and empowering edible shelled out sponsorship money, kneeling there, glumly stacking yogurts. At the fish counter, the seafood team begins. Fish are removed, latex gloves gripping them two at a time, fillets and whole fish, sloppy little bastards, and tossed into the plastic tubs that are their nightly home. The mussels are bagged, the shrimp scooped together into mesh cages. Next, the metal trays come up. These are little more than decorative housing and are promptly sprayed down to remove a day's worth of sweat and oil and torn pieces of flesh that slowed off from handling. Below the trays, a thin plastic webbing for grip, then a layer of ice. Once, individual chips, now grown hard as a skating rink from periodic thaws and re-icing during the day. The surface is littered with the typical debris, fish parts, crumpled up stickers announcing wild caught, errant cockles, cracked mussels. Usually that would be it. Aprons would be stripped off. Giant, foul garbage bags of fish guts and butcher paper would be lugged to the dumpsters in the back. But on this night, the one that comes every other month or so, the case itself is cleaned. An order has come down from high, seemingly at random. And so, for the entire length of the 38-foot case, employees hack the ice into large chunks. It is exactly like shoveling snow in the winter, and they use big, thick shovels to do the job. Standing up on metal platforms to get leverage, they chop straight down, chiseling out 2 by 2 by 2 blocks that they then systematically take out like giant sugar cubes to be melted in the back. It is reasonably physical work, and soon they are sweating. Once the top layer is removed, they begin anew on the layer below, gritting it out, chiseling, pulling out cubes. Beneath this second layer, the ice is more crunchy, less frozen. It's an old freezer and inconsistent, and it only takes a few scrapes before you get to streaks of brown. A few more and the smell comes. It is horrible, and not at all of decomposition, but of fecal waste, maybe sweetened slightly, thick in the air like you're exhuming something dangerous, which perhaps you are. Soon after the smell, the streaks of brown darken and the ice turns with entrails and smashed pieces of shell, the shovel uncovering squid tentacles, crab antenna. All 2 months old, rotten, buried under there, each scrape revealing some new purple color, and the odor is such that you really cannot breathe it long. So neither team member does, instead spelling each other by rushing off to do other tasks like melting the giant cubes under hot water, or just standing to the side and muttering, "How the fuck does it get like this?" Then, at a certain scrape of the shovel, the bottom of the case is revealed, stainless steel, but it's streaked green with bile, gray with pancreatic froth, pink with clam flesh, all strung out and mashed in the ice slurry. To the extent that they are recognizable, the contents are inexplicable and vaguely horrifying. No shrimp were stored in this section of the case, so why the rotting pile of shrimp casings? No whole fish either, so why the set of red lacy gills? Months of slow melting and cracks in the ice and the chaos of retail have allowed it all to accumulate down there in a weird gutter of seafood waste compressed beneath 4.5 feet of ice. Eventually, the ice and slime are removed, and a high-blast hose with a separate nozzle for green concentrated soap is sprayed against the stainless steel bottom. The water is hot, so there is steam. Your glasses fog up, and the rot slithers down the drain. The shells cluster in cracked bits and are removed by hand. Finally, now, somewhere closer to 1 a.m., the case bottom looks clean, even gleaming, and the team goes back to the giant ice machine along the north wall to return with heaping shovels of virginal white snow. Clean ice, the cleanest you've ever seen after that, and they pile it in heaps into the case, building back the buffer between the wet semi-rot that will be the bottom of the case and a top retail surface downy and clean. When they are finished, the ice sparkles. No more skate rink, each chip separate and glittering in the light. The perfect platform to sell good fish. The smell, once choking, is not just muffled but non-existent. A very real and solid barrier has been erected. And once the floor has been sprayed down and mopped across with a giant squeegee, the entire scene will feel like a dream. Tomorrow morning, the fish will be laid down again in their metal trays, cut parsley and trills of red pepper arranged on top, and it won't be unhygienic in the least. It will be undetectable and irrelevant. There will be a thick wall of ice separating the retail surface from the depths below. And in this way, the very real way, the fish case at Whole Foods on the Bowery can be simultaneously appalling and perfectly hygienic and safe. It is a fitting metaphor for the grocery business as a whole and a start to this book. First, lest we get off on the wrong foot, a moment to state how underplayed that description of the opening smell was. Over the course of researching this book, I climbed aboard fishing boats littered with the debris of mashed fish and seaweed left for weeks at a time to roast in the sun. I necropsied chickens, pulling their guts apart, looking for signs of disease as they radiated that lab-specific scent of ammonia and death. I snuck into industrial swine farms and chicken houses, wading through lagoons of feces in the process. And at one point, in Nakhon Si, Thammarat, Thailand, on a 90-degree summer day, I stood ankle-deep in rotten trash fish on the loading dock. 10,000 minnows piled up in silver ribbons left for days as they waited to be transformed into the protein base of the aquaculture pyramid. Those were some strong sniffs. And yet none of it, not the trash fish nor fecal lagoons, was as fundamentally gross and disturbing as the smell that came out of that fish case in Manhattan, in a Whole Foods, in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods, in the wealthiest nation in the world. Which is to say, melodrama has its place in life, but not in my description of smells. Maybe that's an odd note to start a book on, but this is nonfiction. Names have not been changed, except in the few places where I felt my writing might threaten a subject's livelihood. Characters have not been combined. Quotes are either from audio recordings or written down in the moment, and descriptions of smells have not been exaggerated for effect. This book is about the grocery store, about the people who work there and the routes of supply that define it. Is the product of 5 years of research, hundreds of interviews, and thousands of hours tracking down and working alongside the buyers, brokers, marketers, and managers whose lives and choices define our diet. The 5 years were a time of dramatic upheaval. Walmart seized organics. Amazon seized Whole Foods. The promise of automation loomed over trucking. Minimum wage law shifted, giving employees the promise of a new salary floor. Yet, what I found, whether talking to Whole Foods executives about the Amazon deal or to new Amazon employees as they stocked shelves, was that during this upheaval, the most primal drives in the industry weren't so much as disrupted as elevated and laid bare. What emerged is a fascinating and largely hidden world. In 2018, Americans spent $701 billion at supermarket-style grocery stores, still our largest food expenditure by a wide margin. There are 38,000 of these stores across this land, and the average adult will spend 2% of their life inside one. They are the point of interface most familiar and least understood in our food system, bland to the point of invisibility, so routine they blur into background. And yet, the grocery store exists as one of the only places where our daily decisions impact, make us complicit in, a system we have come in equal parts to scorn and see a savior. We've been happy to let more impersonal aspects of our food system, from industrialized slaughterhouses to farm bill subsidies, take up the lion's share of investigation and critique. But to understand how and why our food gets to us in the form it does, the grocery store is a powerful entry point. It is not only the way that most of us are introduced to the system, tagging along with mom as she shops. It is perhaps the best opportunity to understand the system on the terms of the people who operate it on our behalf. And their operation is something to behold. Grocery stores and the supply chain that has grown up around them are shockingly efficient. We spend only 10% of our budget on food, compared to 40% by our great-grandparents in 1900 and 30% by our grandparents in the 1950s. It is a number that's been decreasing the entire century along with the rise of mass supply chains. In the early Republic, around the War of 1812, nearly 90% of the population worked to produce the nation's food. It was a grueling physical life. And in addition to being costly, the food produced was of uneven quality and tightly limited supply and could and did kill through disease. Now less than 3% of our population produces enough food to feed us all. It is easy to wax poetic about food before the rise of industry, about eating the way our grandmother's grandmother ate. But the fact is, we spend less money than almost every other country in the world on food. And we spend less time gathering that food than at any time in history. Somehow, each year those numbers continue to shrink while the quality, quantity, variety, and safety of the food available have gotten better and better. Footnote. Okay, I put this in here to be argumentative. I'm well aware that some modern tomatoes taste like mushy cardboard and that you've never had a real avocado unless you blah, blah, blah. I, too, have traveled to third world countries and rural American farm stands and bitten into, insert authentic version of otherwise ordinary food product here, and had a transcendent, almost revelatory experiences as the juices drooled down my throat. I'm not convinced this means it's appropriate to lord these experiences over the entire food system or lament a bygone era where these moments were routine and food was not debased. Largely because I don't think these moments were ever routine. Quality between epochs is an incredibly hard thing to measure. Facets once highly desired, like the age of a hen at slaughter, fall out of fashion. The value of what we no longer have expands in our imagination. In the 1920s, fancy New York restaurants advertised their food miles, proudly touting the distance each ingredient traveled on the menu as a symbol of sophistication. Now we see the same measure as a proxy for carbon footprint and wince. End footnote. So, within a century, we've cut the rates of hunger and nutritional deficiency to historic lows, reduced foodborne illness to a rounding error, and democratized food that was once the height of luxury into fare for everyday consumption. And we've been so successful in all these endeavors that we now grapple with a series of problems entirely unprecedented in the history of humanity, of too much food, of using food to distribute ethical responsibility, of food as a proxy for control in our own increasingly detached lives. All those facts are interesting, but not why I wanted to learn about the grocery store. When I was 19, I went to Kenya and lived with no running water, no electricity, no communication with the outside world. I had signed on as a field researcher, studying blue monkeys with binoculars and gumboots, racing around the literal jungle with a notebook, trying to follow the arboreal path of what looked, to my completely untrained eye, like oversized gray cats, grooming each other, humping, and hissing in angry confrontation. There were no phone lines strung to our field station, and this was before cell phones really existed, except in movies as big brick-shaped devices signifying outrageous wealth. So our sole means of communication with the outside world began with a 1.5-mile walk from our forest hut to a tree, known as the bicycle taxi stand, where we could commission an hour-long tandem bicycle ride over dirt roads, transfer to a motorized van at a cement junction, and then finally, after a half hour in the van, arrive at a town large enough to support a post office, where we could buy aerograms for a few pennies to get word to an anxious mother that all was well. Details from that summer flood in if I squint my eyes and try. They are wonderful when I can grab them. But the memory that comes to me unbidden, at odd moments, with eerie intensity, in fact, perhaps the definitional memory of my entire summer of being 19 and in the Kenyan rainforest, didn't actually occur in Kenya. After months of this life, waking with the sun, going to sleep to the light of an oil lantern, my only external sounds from the rainforest itself, deafening, chaotic, and multi-paneled, the auditory equivalent of the 10,000 shades of blue you might see while staring out at the Mediterranean, after weeks of cooking the same cabbage dinner on a gas stove, of storing my cheese at room temperature, of learning the rhythms of the space, the daily 30-minute equatorial thunderstorms, whereby the air would transform into long, translucent sheets of rain flapping and whipping in the wind, a summer where I hitchhiked, bathed in rainwater, hand-washed my clothes, and wiped my ass with leaves. The single definitional memory of that summer, the one that is seared into my brain, came only when I arrived back home. It's a memory from my first night in New York, after wandering the streets in a daze, well past midnight, and finding myself in the aisles of the West Side Market grocery store on 112th and Broadway. The memory is of my first night in that store, my body wandering down the aisles, eyes falling over the easy abundance, mind chewing over the scene like a dog gnawing on the very bone of Western civilization. I remember stepping in through the curtain of air conditioning, pacing the cement waxed floors, my stretched reflection gleaming back like a shadow, my pulse slow and easy, my eyes scanning the cereal boxes banked high on both sides, the pontoons of 2-liter soda bottles, and most memorably, the cold counter of prepared foods, rows of chicken breasts, deli meats, and an oozing, seemingly never-touched giant bowl of octopus salad, serving spoon permanently wedged in its mayonnaise like the sword in a stone. I would puzzle over that octopus salad like a riddle, like I was stoned out of my gourd, which I was most certainly not, except in some metaphoric sense. I would stand there, taking it in, almost feeling the store respire. The memory is crystalline in a way that feels false, a characteristic known as flashbulb memory, which I've since learned is associated with trauma. In my memory, I'm dazed and confounded and in love in that grocery store, a love like all love, filled with doubt and rage and insecurity, but also overwhelming and blanketing, warm and intoxicating. It was a love of reacclimation, of reabsorbing a childhood and birthright, of seeing myself and my country with new eyes, both fearful and reverent. And that, my definitional memory of a Kenyan summer full of memories, is where this book comes from. A secular revelation. To almost everyone in the actual industry, food is just another CPG, or consumer packaged good. This is true whether they enter the industry as a chef, a Harvard Business School grad, or a cancer survivor vegan doctor intent on change. It is true regardless of the rhetoric that graces their package or the percent of their profits they donate to virtuous causes. It is true because that's what it means to enter the system. It is a necessary requirement of acting on scale. If you want to open even a single market fruit stand, you're suddenly dealing with a product that is flowing through you, that has been purchased and will either be sold or discarded as waste, and that is defined in your eyes by its economic properties alongside its nutritional, aesthetic, and ethical dimensions. When you expand to the scale of even a small grocery chain, the economic factors can't help but envelop everything else. Qualities like ethics and aesthetics get swallowed by the market and reduced to price. The average store has 32,000 individuated products known as shopkeeping units, or SKUs. The biggest have more than 120,000 SKUs. Accordingly, the men and women who sell our food, who work amidst this volume, see our food differently than you or I. In particular, they see it as a line on a spreadsheet, with reams of qualities arrayed in columns, all weighted by various coefficients according to their particular proprietary model that culminates in one or two numbers used to determine its value. The very same item they might have eaten for breakfast transubstantiates into something entirely non-ecological when they head to work. Not really that different from thumbtacks or paper towels, though perhaps with slightly more fragile handling conditions. This is something those on the inside are acutely aware of. Once, talking to a slaughter plant supervisor, a man who proudly declared he'd been present for the execution of 800 million chickens, I listened as he practically broke down describing the moments just after a chicken's death. The man was detailing the procession of events that leads to slaughter. After the catchers come through in their overalls, grabbing up the birds by hand. After they stuff the birds into their horizontal cages for transport, muddy cotton balls jammed against the steel. And after the cages are driven miles and miles to the plant, then removed by forklift, and the birds are yanked out, again by hand, and hung upside down on the line by their yellow, scaly feet, they head toward a machine that will slice their carotid artery, 140 birds a minute, while a man in a blood-stained smock looks on with raised knife, ready in case the machine misses and he has to step forward to finish the job. After the man in the neck slicing, the birds, still twitching, still warm, draining out, in short, still very much animals, though dying ones, are whisked into a dark metallic tunnel. This is the place. The place where the slaughter plant supervisor's voice wells up during his description. The tunnel continues through to a new room. But inside, encased in industry, invisible except on blueprints and design plans, something happens. The bird is blasted with hot, steaming water, beaten by rubber flanges so its feathers fall off in ragged clumps. It is cleansed at an existential level until on the other side of this tunnel, the chicken emerges into a new room, now a decapitated, drained thing, all white-pocked skin, a whizzing, gleaming globe of meat racing forward on the line. There is a phase shift. The floors are now bloodless. Men and women in white smocks stand at green plastic counters, and the whole area radiates with the high, reassuring notes of chlorine. That is the precise point they go from living thing to food. You watch it happen, he says, his voice breaking, as into tears, but not in the remorseful or guilt-ridden sense, in the I am blessed and witness to a miraculous sense. They come out, and they are no longer an animal. They are food now. It's a fundamental rite of civilization, a moment where the industry mimics the god, but rather than breathing new life into dust, a different consecration occurs, of sucking life out, an act of not just absolving murder, but erasing the possibility. A very similar process occurs in the retail store. Those deboned, bulk-chilled chicken breasts, or Granny Smith apples, or long fillets of frozen salmon, or whatever other food you want to imagine, arrive to the stores in their cardboard boxes, vacuum-sealed in a marvel of plastic packaging, and when you click your box cutter down and reach to take them out, they cease being food. Another transformation has occurred. They are product now. Merchandise. SKUs. Listen to the retail managers and assistant managers talk among themselves. The word food doesn't come up. It is an irrelevant, unhelpful, even illogical way to discuss the work of grocery. To these men, it's always product. And so in the same way the fecal shrieking bird ceases being an animal and becomes food, an item within the grocery matrix loses its identity as food and becomes product. It is liberated. Its transformation is no less critical to the project of civilization. Now it is defined by the cubic inches of its packaging, its price per unit, and the velocity of its sales. It is not until much later, the moment the customer comes pushing their cart down the aisle and reaches out for that styrofoam tray, that our chicken becomes food again. It's a tenuous thing, but suddenly it has a new owner and a new meaning. Now it will be eaten, and everything that matters about it has changed to reflect that fact. Detailing these pivot points isn't a weird exercise in categorization or linguistics. These shifts have material effects. As a culture, we do a generally excellent to overzealous job thinking about food. A highly conflicted job thinking about its origins in the natural world as a living thing, and spend almost no time thinking about our groceries as a retail product. It is simply elided in our brains, in our arguments, in our attempts to intervene into the system as advocates. The men and women who work in the grocery industry do not actually speak another language when they discuss food, but the words they use refer to parallel attributes in the same thing. And when you start digging into precisely how the people in grocery think, you find one thing open and waiting in the center, the maw, that voracious, devouring hole we feed 3 to 30 times a day, swallowing and salivating and stuffing, ceaseless in its demands right up to the point we lie in a hospital bed and it gets temporarily assisted by a polyurethane tube. The maw, to me, like the sun above, interfacing with the chloroplast below the leaf, is more than just a mouth. It's a secular revelation, a complex of destruction and creativity anchored in need. It is the sensory cell of the gut, the neuronal charges to acquire, the curiosities, comforts, and cravings we convince ourselves are necessities. It, like the Vedic concept of self, comes in the universal as well as the personal. Each of our unique pie holes mirror tributaries to some more tremendous vortex right at the heart of the human project. And it is this maw, more than anything, that animates the wonks in the grocery back room, poring over their spreadsheets, deciding how to stock our shelves. More than greed, health, altruism, grocery wants to serve. The fact that we make serving that need so complicated, the fact that it ends in the contradiction that is the Whole Foods fish counter, beautiful and vile at the same time, should not be an invitation to scorn the system, or ourselves, but an opportunity for introspection and perhaps even growth. And ultimately, it should upend our perception of grocery, to remember it isn't about food. It never has been about food. Food is the business of eating. Grocery, we'll see, that's completely different. It's the business of desire.